Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect brings you to archival interviews from the last provincial election on housing. With a footnote, we're looking for the speaker for next week's show on why the AODA accommodations in the building code for people with disabilities and the AODA tribunal haven't materialized, as Dalton McGuinty and the AODA said they would.
Disrespect, welcome to the show. Jed Kilbourne, Tenant Organizing and Outreach of the Federation of Metro Tenants Associations. Jed, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We met at the Davenport Perth Neighborhood Center discussing questions to ask candidates in the upcoming election about housing and particularly tenant housing, which is your bailiwick.
Yeah.
I left the meeting early. Did you find that they had come up with any questions to ask candidates by the end of the meeting?
It was interesting. I think people had specific questions in mind, but I think that the decisions were to essentially continue asking questions amongst each other.
To develop
better questions, essentially. Yeah. I think that the main challenge was thinking up questions that were particularly relevant to Davenport Perth, as opposed to broader questions, you know?
Are Davenport Perth needs, in your view, all that unusual, that the questions, that their questions wouldn't be applicable to other communities?
No. In fact, I think that ultimately there's a lot of these issues, specifically around tenant advocacy and tenant rights, can be shared throughout the province even, right? Like, the legislation is provincial. And so it's funny, I don't think it's necessarily unique to Davenport Perth, except I think that a better understanding of the candidates in a particular riding can help focus the questions, right? And I think that that's where people certainly wanted to do a little bit more research, I imagine.
Yeah. So for anyone in another riding who was thinking of questions to ask their candidates, the first thing you would probably suggest then would be research the candidate. Find out what questions they will be able to answer and what questions they won't.
Totally. And then also I think that the STOP, which is the center that we were working with, their main influence in that area is Toronto Community Housing, right? So subsidized housing or social housing. And that kind of gained prominence in the spring with the Toronto Star doing a big expose on the badly managed Toronto housing, right?
Right.
And so that would be something that would be unique to that neighborhood. But
I don't think it is. I think that neighborhood's got a better handle on it. But from what I can see, the lack of maintenance of public housing is a problem in every community, probably just worse in Toronto because of the budget shortage that they're suffering.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you. But I think that specific targets like that, in terms of doing research, so if you were doing research in housing in a particular area, that would be something that would be great to find because it proves a really good tool for engaging politicians in a conversation, right?
Right.
You start at a kind of a locus. And I think that's a tool that can be used for any kind of political discussion, right? And I think the other thing that was wonderful about what we did there was, in terms of engaging people and helping them frame questions, they had people whose jobs it is to know the questions, like me, for tenant advocacy stuff.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate you being on the show for that very reason. Now, one of the questions that came to my mind was, what is going to be asked about the working poor? What's going to be asked about the minimum wage and the long wait for it to be upped, and its relationship to shelter costs and health and community cohesiveness. Did anybody raise that there?
Well, one of the things that we tried doing was looking at some of the intersections between housing and child care and health and, frankly, the minimum wage, right?
Right.
And I think that there are some very material realities going on here, right? One is that especially in cities like Toronto, but almost everywhere in Ontario except for three real areas in Ontario, rents have increased.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that ultimately, when you take into account issues of a minimum wage, mm-hmm. one of the things that even landlord advocates suggest is, well, we need to raise the minimum wage. And I agree. I think that the minimum wage is abysmal at $8 an hour.
Landlords have suggested this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh. Everyone understands that a minimum wage needs to be met. And I think that that's partly in reaction to us saying, well, you need to lower your rents. And their response usually is, well, raise the minimum wage. And as a tenant organization, our argument is we don't need to raise the minimum wage just to account for your exorbitant rent. Mm-hmm. The minimum wage should be raised because people are unable to live on it, not just because of housing costs. Shelter costs end up being, generally, should be 30% of someone's rent, but the reality is more and more tenants are paying 50% of their income on shelter.
When was the last time the minimum wage was increased? Do you know?
I don't know.
I can't remember. I'm going to put my foot in it here on air and just say I would bet it was the NDP before 1995. I have no idea.
And it'd be interesting to compare that to the rate of inflation, never mind the fact that by law, according to the Residential Tenancies Act and the Tenant Protection Act before that, landlords mm-hmm. are guaranteed an increase of a certain percentage amount every year.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless whether they do work on the building, even.
Yeah. Well, I have some facts from the ACTO website, the Advocacy mm-hmm. Center for Tenants Ontario, for people who are not familiar with the acronym. And apparently, the increase in average rent in all Ontario, the units surveyed annually by Central Mortgage and Housing, produced an average increase of 28% from 1995 to 2005. And that outpaces even the Consumer Price Index, which was 23% increase in the same period. Now, I'm sure that minimum wages didn't go up by a quarter in that time.
No.
So there's something amiss in that
Absolutely.
Equation, and it's not being addressed.
No, exactly. I think that kind of culturally, we believe in certain absolutes, and one of them is this truth that, well, rents are always going to go up. It's kind of like death or taxes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so I think that over the years, it's just essentially, it can be really difficult to mobilize around because to a certain degree, it's felt really hopeless in the past.
Yeah.
Especially after years of the Tenant Protection Act.
Yeah. Well, we have the Residential Tenancies Act now, which is Tenant Protection Act by another name, I guess, except it's changed the eviction rules.
Yes.
All right.
And some of the rules around above guideline increases, but
yeah.
generally speaking, it's a very similar piece of legislation.
Are the tribunals the same? Are they still essentially landlords' tribunals?
From what we see, yes.
Okay.
Though it's still fairly early to tell, but I think that unless you were to have entirely new appointees, you're still dealing with many of the same adjudicators that were there.
Yeah, that's true.
The Tenant Protection Act. So I believe in the ability of human beings to change, right?
Like, yeah, yeah.
I believe in that, but I also question that ability when a legislation is changed, the ability for people to change that quickly. Certainly there have been Liberal appointees
yeah.
to the various boards throughout the province, but we're keeping an eye on them.
You've been listening to the Federation of Metro Tenants Association Jed Kilmorne discuss housing, health, social costs, and questions you might want to ask your candidate in the upcoming provincial election. And before our next clip, listen to Danny Gatton and Elmira Street Boogie.
look at this 28% increase in rents. But then again, fixed incomes have fallen in real terms since 1995. And this has got to mean an increase in homelessness.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
From this site again, 96% of Ontario Works beneficiaries are tenants. Only 17% live in subsidized housing. 78% of ODSP, Ontario Disability Support Program beneficiaries, are tenants, but only 22% live in subsidized housing. What is happening for these people?
Not a lot.
Yeah, okay.
Frankly.
Yeah, all right. I can appreciate that.
It's difficult, and the waiting list for social housing is years long, right?
Yeah, 13 years in Toronto. When you go into the office, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, it's gotten too expensive. We can't give out maps of where the units are anymore.
Right.
And all that kind of sort of, you know, we're doing you a big favor. And that seems to be a more recent development for some reason, maybe out of the city budget shortage. I don't know.
I think it's existed for millennia, probably, but there certainly is a culture of contempt for the poor, right? Whether it's working poor or people on income support or whatever, right? And I think that ends up, even in progressive social service agencies, that can end up influencing people who come into quote-unquote contact with the poor. And even with government agencies, right? Like, you find this over and over again where workers end up treating people, their clients, with contempt.
Yeah.
Certainly that's been our experience with the Ontario Rental Housing Tribunal and even a little bit with the Landlord and Tenant Board.
Yeah.
There's this really entrenched idea that we have, and that becomes an example of this entrenched idea that we have, that wealth is not transient, but poverty is transient. And poverty is something that, well, if you just pulled yourself up by your bootstraps, you would gain wealth.
So poverty need not last. But
exactly. But wealth will always last. It's an absolute.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Okay.
So, and I think that articulates really nicely the kind of contempt that we feel for poor people, right? Like, essentially, the idea that, well, if you had wealth, you should have held on to it, and it's your own fault that you didn't. It's not the fact that people lose jobs or are taken seriously ill or things like that. And those things end up creating a culture of diminishing health, diminishing ability. Wealth is one of those things that is, in fact, transient, but it's not necessarily as moralistic as we imagine it to be.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think it's probably easy when you know someone doesn't have the money to seek redress, when you know that the legal aid system is way overburdened and not able to serve the people whose mandate it is to serve them, when you know that the Human Rights Commission has been way overburdened and is now under further attack from the McGuinty government, that you really have a free ticket to take it out on people who don't have the means to come back.
Absolutely.
I don't know what is in any of the platforms to address this. I just did a show on how to hire a lawyer when you don't have any money.
Yeah.
And it was a lawyer, James Kerr, wrote into the Star and said the saving grace for people under the new Ontario human rights measures will be that it has been legal for a few years in Ontario to hire a lawyer on contingency. Now, not everybody can exert the effort required to secure one. Not everybody can make the impression on one. Not everyone's articulate enough to explain their case so that a lawyer can pick up on a lawyer who's affluent and able and probably born into the, in most cases, probably born into the middle class. Explain to them why there is a problem and why it should be addressed and why they should do it on their own, at risk for their own funds rather than be paid up front.
Yeah.
And I don't see any solutions to the problem of legal aid. I don't see any solutions to the problem of human rights. And these seem to be all around the problem of housing. You know, if your housing is unhealthy, you really don't have a large array of tools to address that issue.
No, and in fact, I think that the intersections of all of these things are fairly starkly obvious, right? And the reality is that, I mean, you can take it's funny, it's kind of like one of those games that you play when you're driving with your folks in a car, and you start off with someone's name and then start drawing links to their name, like the six degrees of Kevin Bacon, right? So basically you can start at any point, like, okay, so I just lost my job, and you can essentially create a narrative that creates these situations that many people face all the time. So I lose my job, therefore I can't make rent, so my landlord evicts me. I'm already really probably unbearably stressed out because I'm losing my housing. Now I have the chance to represent myself at a hearing.
Yeah.
I know that I haven't paid rent, so a lot of tenants kind of go, well, why would I go to the hearing? I know that I haven't paid rent. I couldn't afford to.
Yeah.
How am I going to argue that?
Yeah.
So they don't go.
Right.
And what we do is we encourage tenants to go to their hearings, because even then, part of the new landlord and tenant board is that it's designed to be quote-unquote more tenant-friendly, which means that it will take into account situational occurrences, right?
Oh, okay, that's a nice
The
change.
Reality is, okay, so I've now just lost my job because I got downsized. I know that I haven't paid rent, and I decide to not go to the hearing because how am I going to explain that? So I don't go to the hearing, and there's an order out against me. In the meantime, I'm trying to find other housing. The difficulty is I can't use my past landlord as reference because
right.
I just defaulted on my rent.
Yeah.
So I don't have a reference, never mind the fact that I also don't have income at this point, but in order to apply for any income assistance, I need an address, but I don't have an address because I'm about to be evicted. Added to that, this continuing stress, I start getting sicker.
Yeah.
You know, like, you can just snowball this, and it becomes a really fun game while you're in the car, but for an increasing number of people in Ontario, it's a reality, and it's disgusting that we allow people to live like that.
I recall one of the questions that came up at the Devonport Perth Neighborhood Center was to ask a politician how they understand the links between these things, and that struck me as a shrewd question that would apply in any riding. You would get an idea of the politician's understanding of the social and health consequences of these inadequate incomes.
Absolutely. I think part of that, and I absolutely agree with you, basically what I want to see is not only elected officials working for us, but I'm tired of the kind of the discourses around electoral campaigns where people essentially have, on a provincial level, it's not as glaring as on a federal level. But I'm tired
over who
of
will
kind
pay.
Of a,
you mean?
Sorry.
Arguments over who will pay?
Not just who will pay, but essentially, like, I want to see politicians work to get elected, right? And so
right.
I want to see them do the work of figuring out what relationship these things have to each other, right?
Yeah.
It's fair to say, like, well, do you think that the province should upload the funds for social housing that they downloaded onto the municipalities 8 years ago.
Right.
Well, yeah, a politician can take a party line, but I don't actually care about party lines as much as I care about a politician who's able to see the fact that none of these things are unique, and nor are they, oh, well, this lobby group wanted this and this lobby group wanted this. These things are all inherently linked.
Yeah.
Right? And questions like that can start getting at the root of that, right?
So the integrity of his credentials is linked to the integrity of his understanding of the links between all these things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So he's, as you say, he's either spouting from something that he's rehearsed or memorized and doesn't understand, or he's thinking.
Exactly.
And he's trying to
and
solve
I want
problems.
Some evidence that the person I'm going to elect thinks.
Yeah, right.
You know, I want evidence that someone can go, yeah, I understand the fact that if you're poor, you don't have the same choice, quote unquote, when it comes to finding your apartment,
mm-hmm.
because you're limited by how much money you make. So that idea of choice is a myth.
Yeah.
It creates a skewed market where landlords know, well, listen, I don't really have to do a lot, and I know that I'm always going to get tenants if I keep my rent this low.
Yeah.
So you start getting slums.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Now we come to the shortage of affordable housing. Everybody's talked this subject to death. There doesn't seem to be a lot of action on this front. I understand there was some provincial money that came this way, though. Are you aware of it?
Not a ton.
Yeah, right.
Not a ton.
Okay, and what was it for?
The provincial money was essentially, it was a way of subsidizing families whose income, I believe, was less than $20,000. Hang on, it's called the ROOF program.
That sounds like a lot of families.
It probably is.
And not a lot of money.
Yeah, so you have to be working.
Yeah.
Have earned an income of at least $5,000 and a net family income below $20,000.
Okay.
And there are a number of qualifications, right? You have to have one or more dependent children under the age of 18. You have to be paying more than 30% of your income towards rent. And you have to have less than $10,000 in liquid assets.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be receiving social assistance or any other subsidy. And you have to be a resident of Ontario and meet program requirements for status in Canada.
For the few people who meet these requirements, where would they apply?
It's called the ROOF program, and it's out of Oshawa. You can go to www.ontario.ca/roof.
Okay.
The reality, though, is it's $100 per month.
Ooh.
starting in January of 2008.
Okay. All right. So if you make it through Christmas, maybe there'll be some help.
And if you make meet all the eligibility requirements, and even then, it doesn't address the fact that we don't have affordable housing here.
That's true.
One of the best ways of addressing that is to bring back a form of rent control. And also start funding more social housing.
Well, social housing is a complete answer in itself because, I mean, the landlord has control of the cost, the landlord has control of the expenses, the landlord even has control of alternative means to raise funds. Why is there so much resistance to social housing?
I think it's considered an expense. It's the same.
Oh, I see. Yeah, like bus fares or something.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if we don't pay for people to get downtown, then we'll all be richer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So there are questions to be asked around social housing, too.
Absolutely. Both affordable and social housing, right? Like,
what are the questions you would ask?
I think that the province needs to pick up their responsibility uploading of costs. I think it's unfair that municipalities, not just unfair, it's almost impossible
it's
for municipalities to be responsible for this. And frankly, the larger the municipality, and this isn't just unique for Toronto, it's true of any large municipality, the larger the municipality, the likelier it is that people from outlying areas will come in. So they end up bearing a huge burden in terms of housing people.
Okay.
And in fact, without the adequate income, they can't build adequate housing to afford the people that are coming in.
Right.
Right? In Toronto, between 1997 and 2003, the number of one-bedroom units with rents below $700 per month shrank by 85%.
Wow.
And the number of two-bedroom units with rents below $800 shrank by 89%.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so what we saw, in fact, wasn't a huge glut of new housing built or anything like that. We just saw rents going up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've come up with an interesting little bag of questions, and I'm sure a listener can come up with more if they want to give some thought to the question. But the first one is that I recall we figured was worth asking was, do the landlords understand the links to an inadequate minimum wage, and do they understand the links in general to inadequate housing, inadequate wages, homelessness, health costs, and that they should be called upon to account for these links rather than be given them and asked for a quick answer?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The inadequate shelter allowance, we haven't explicitly dealt with, but inadequate incomes in general on the fixed income side, I think anybody can be asked for that.
If you're living in the private market, it becomes unbearable because ultimately you're going to be edged out of your place to live.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of the clients, the tenants that I end up dealing with, who are not only just facing annual increases, but facing increases above the guideline amount, are often on fixed incomes.
Yeah, yeah, and fixed incomes, which, as we discussed, have gone down in real terms.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Despite the 2% increase supposedly coming in November, the incomes after that will still have gone down in real terms.
Oh, absolutely.
And then we addressed the affordable housing and want to ask, what are they going to do about the restrictions on rent controls? What are they going to do about the shortage of affordable housing? What are they going to do about the shortage of social housing?
Totally, totally.
Hopefully voters can come up with more of those questions related to housing. The best advice that I've gotten with questions so far came from Andrea Calver, who asked, why don't you ask questions from your own experience? That way you won't be tripped up by some political nicety or some development you're unaware of. You're asking directly from your own experience of shortage and hardship. And you'll know instinctively when the answer comes whether it's an answer that will work or not.
Totally, totally. Yeah. Shows like this can help.
Well, you'd also mentioned researching the candidates, and I almost forgot to review that. We mentioned finding out about the candidates that you're addressing so that you can approach them specifically in your riding as well as their party and your issue.
Totally.
And combine the three into something that really strikes home and can be given a comprehensive answer.
Totally.
All right.
Frankly, if people are interested in and they have access to computers, they're always welcome to go to our website as well.
Okay.
Which is www.torontotenants.org. And we put together an election kind of advocacy kit.
Good. I'm putting this together with an interview with Mary Vaughan in Halifax. She's got chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, diabetes, cancer. She's in her 70s. and her landlord was evicting her. The legal clinic she called Canadian Press, and it made the national papers. Now that the press has died down, the landlord said, "You just wait, you know, till the press dies down, and we'll still be here." And apparently, that's what they're doing. They're back to trying to evict her again. And I'm going to do a 5-minute update with her, and couple it to this interview when I post it on the web. Would your organization be interested in putting a link to the interview on your website prior to the election? This will be a half-hour broadcast right now, but the web show will be an hour.
Okay.
And we'll take it from there and see what kind of response you get.
Yeah, for sure. We'll put it on our links page for sure.
Thanks.
No problem.
All right. Well, I appreciate you being here with us after work hours today. So many of the people I interview do interview after work hours, and it's very generous. Thanks, Jed.
No problem. My pleasure.
All right. Well, we'll see you again.
Absolutely.
All right.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Federation of Metro Tenants Association, Jed Kilmore, and discuss housing, health, social costs, and questions you might want to ask your candidate in the upcoming provincial election. Next up, developer John Harstone on the past and a very plausible future for Ontario social housing. Next up, John Harstone on the past and a very plausible future of social housing. Danny Gatton and Apache Surf Medley.
Respect welcomes John Harstone, a consultant helping housing groups develop affordable housing. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We were talking yesterday about the drop-off in real estate values, which is far less in Canada than in the States, but nevertheless, it's really crimped Toronto style for developing social housing. Because they use condo fees. You mentioned that only Toronto and Vancouver are the two cities that you're aware of that do that.
Yes. I mean, they're one of the things about the amount of condominium development here and in Vancouver, they've been able to use monies generated by condos to essentially help with the development of affordable housing. And that's not something that's going on in most of the other cities in Canada.
Right. What we started talking about was what would happen to affordable housing in the rest of the country if this avenue is not open to them and government revenues go down, land values go down, and contractors start looking for other work.
Well, contractors are going to be starting to look for other work. We've got a whole downturn we expect in the Canadian construction industry. And in Toronto, I think we're predicting that there'll be, in sort of 2010, half as many construction starts as there were last year.
Okay.
But the question around whether the downturn is going to impact affordable housing, it's very expensive, and the government has to make some sort of financial contribution to get it built. And so the real key thing here is that getting a contribution from the government, either it can be the lower interest rates or it can be the form of a capital grant. And if the government has a program to do that, and the Harper government has promised to continue some of the affordable housing programs as part of their election campaign.
They were more like homeless programs, weren't they?
There were homeless, but they also are
Skippy,
helping
yeah?
develop affordable rental and some affordable ownership as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't big.
They weren't big, and there weren't a lot of units. But if those programs continue, mm-hmm. the downturn in the whole general housing market will make it a little bit easier to build because land prices will be lower and the construction prices will be somewhat lower as well. Mm-hmm. So it'll make it a little bit easier to build.
Yeah, okay. So we won't be competing with hungry developers for land because they'll be nursing their wounds trying to sell the inventory that they have. And we won't be competing with them for tradespeople because their work is done and they're waiting for the economy to pick up again in the private market so they'll be available for the public market.
That's right.
It could be a boon then for social housing, provided, as you say, the government funds are there.
That's right. Yeah.
Do we have any indication the government funds are there or will be there or will not be there?
Well, The Harper government did indicate that there would be funds made available for both homeless programs and affordable housing programs. The exact extent and the timing, I think, is still uncertain. I think we have to believe that it's going to happen. I think there is an enormous need for this kind of housing, and I think the government is going to certainly come forward with some sort of program, but the timing is very uncertain at this moment.
Okay. So the Harper government has continued a few programs. You think that we can count on them for some more, but we don't know how much and we don't know when.
That's right.
And the McGuinty government, it's hard to know whether to believe Dalton McGuinty or Dwight Duncan. Dalton McGuinty's backpedaling that we may have to slow down, and Dwight Duncan saying, well, we're not going to back off our anti-poverty campaign. So it's hard to believe which of them is telling us something closer to the truth. What do you think is going to happen in Ontario with funding? Because with just federal conservative funding, I can't see it happening. Can you?
Well, the federal conservative funding is linked into contributions from the province and the municipalities of some sort as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if the federal government comes forward with dollars, they're expecting Ontario to contribute as well. And so it's really contingent on
Ontario.
Oh,
so they'll twist their arm.
That's right. So it'll twist their arm. And how they give that money and how it's structured is still to be worked out. And I suspect there's going to be some very interesting negotiations between all levels of government.
Any of them scheduled yet?
Not that I know about.
So people have to keep their ear to the ground if they want to know what's going on.
That's right, yes. And there's
okay.
going to be the activists who are in this area, and they're out there sort of pushing and trying to get this thing to happen. But they still have to name a cabinet and go on from there before there's not going to be any real work on this.
Yeah, and then Christmas. I saw the article in The Star today by Armin Yelnisian and a couple of other housing economists, well, poverty economists, on the question of attacking poverty being more important with the pullback in employment and the stability of existing companies than it would be in good times, because the money is a flow through for everybody concerned. That you give the money to people with low incomes and it flows out into the market. I imagine that would also point to the advantage of affordable housing to stabilize these people's lives and put them in a position where the investment in their lives can flow back out into the market too. Am I right?
Or, oh, absolutely.
I'm not an economist.
No. In fact, it's not even economics as much as, on some levels, it's just good sense.
Yeah.
If you can give people good, solid housing,
mm-hmm.
the benefits are, the indicators we've seen are improvements in health,
mm-hmm.
improvements in the school achievement by their children,
uh-huh.
Improvements in income, because they're getting their housing stabilized, they're able to go out and get work. There's a whole range of improvements. The other thing that starts to happen is you give people better quality housing, they start having more pride in their neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
you improve a general sense of safety in the community. There's been an enormous number of positive spin-offs for society by addressing housing.
So they're both short and long term, these benefits.
Oh.
The savings start now, but the savings grow into the future.
Well, that's absolutely the case, and particularly if you're dealing with sort of the people who've been homeless. A lot of those people are now using, for instance, services, hospitals, police, food banks, all of these services, which if you can stabilize them and get them into housing, can be provided at a fraction of the cost if they're in housing as opposed to being on the streets.
Yeah, for sure. And some of those savings areas are excruciatingly important. The rumor that I heard was that healthcare has hit the wall expense-wise. And so anything that is, can save the health budget without cutting back on care is suddenly golden.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Do either level of government buy this argument? I mean, I know activists do, and I know the people living it do, because they see the difference in their own health. But do either level of governments buy into the idea that they can save on the health budget by investing in things like housing and income stabilization?
I think, I can't say whether the governments do. I mean, there are certainly people, individuals in the government, who do, and there's certainly people in, for instance, the hospitals, who are quite aware that you've got to work on getting the housing as a component of getting these people no longer to use the hospitals as emergency rooms as their family doctors.
Yeah, exactly.
So they certainly, in that sense, are people in the health system who are working towards trying to come up with a more rational approach to providing these services and seeing housing as part of an essential part of that service and solution.
Okay.
You've been listening to social housing developer John Harstone discuss the present and the future of social housing under declining revenues and falling real estate prices in Ontario.
So the cabinet federally has to be arranged, and then we have to get through the Christmas season, and that then we can expect, surprise, surprise, we can expect Stephen Harper to twist Dalton McGuinty's arm and maybe, for some blandishments in terms of fairness funding for Ontario to get housing off the ground between the two of them. Where would people look for word of this? How would they, be aware of the beginning and enable themselves? I think the most important thing is enable themselves to participate in, to advocate where it's most effective when the movement starts to happen.
Well, my hunch is that it usually becomes public when they're federal, provincial, territorial ministers' meetings. The housing ministers get together periodically,
okay.
And those meetings are where where these deals get hammered out. And so when they announce a meeting where they're going to get all of the ministers together, which is a big undertaking, that's usually meaning that this has finally gotten all the behind the scenes work is out of the way, and we're moving forward to getting some real action.
Okay, so when it's all set up, we have some money set aside, some programs promised. We've seen how long it takes these federal provincial initiatives to get off the ground, 4 or 5 years sometimes.
Absolutely.
The interval of another election. What do activists and people with an interest in social housing do in the meantime to improve the situation? How do they move this thing along over the period of years that it takes to iron out the wrinkles between the province and the feds and make you know, get shovels in the ground and see that they're not canceled by an incoming government. Perhaps by then there are still only holes in the ground, and we've seen that happen too.
I can't answer about whether we'd be able to stop project from being canceled.
Yeah.
But in fact, one of the things which is happening right now is that we're still the affordable housing projects, at least in Toronto, there's a whole bunch of them that haven't started construction yet because it's taken so long just to get all of the approvals in place, all the funding in place, and everything else. So they're not...
We're talking city approvals as
well?
Well,
city approvals, yeah. City approvals, there's a whole... I mean, and OMB and things like that.
Yeah.
So that's... they're going to probably starting next spring, and they're going to take between 12 and 18 months to build. So, in fact, we're looking at probably another 2 years for some of these projects. So many of the activists are involved are seeing construction and projects which are like 2 years away.
Mm-hmm.
So if in the a year from now there was an announcement of a new program, people would say this is beginning to make some sense. Maybe we can push to get these programs in place so that when the projects we're working on now are built, we can get another bunch of projects, get them going as well.
And the programs you're talking about are which?
Well, the programs right now that are building housing, helping to build housing, is the Federal Provincial Affordable Housing Program, which is the Ontario government and the federal government are working together.
Okay.
And they've got a program which encourages affordable rental housing.
Really?
Yep.
And what's its nature? Startup costs?
No, it provides $70,000 a unit as a grant, up to $70,000.
Wow.
And they want to see the housing brought in at about 80% of the CMHC average market rents.
Now, okay.
I'm not sure what those rents are in Hamilton, but they're in Toronto, a one-bedroom average rent's about $900.
So you've
got to be 20% below that.
Too. Okay.
And so that's the kind of numbers that they're looking at. They've also would like targeted for people living with mental illness and women fleeing violence to be living in these buildings. So they're looking at housing providers who can help them meet their goals of providing housing to people who need it the most.
Okay, so that's part of this federal-provincial deal.
Yes.
And you mentioned there were other programs?
Well, there are some other programs that have been that are in process in the sense that there's been a federal government has a homeless partnership initiative,
mm-hmm.
which has been providing some capital grants. Now, that's not sort of, I guess that those funds have been allocated a number of months ago, mm-hmm. but there's a similar program to that one that's being anticipated under the new government as well. So there is programs are designed for dealing with people who are homeless as well as programs designed to help people who are working poor who need a decent housing, having a hard time finding a place to rent.
Which is the one that's in place and which is the one that's anticipated?
Well, both of those programs are in place in the sense that they've all been funded and all the funds have been allocated
right.
and they're being built. And we're anticipating there'll be extensions of both of them.
Oh, extensions, okay.
Yeah,
when do those come?
Or that they would be considered new programs. I mean, every government...
Yeah.
You know, comes up with a new name for the program.
So did the old ones expire with the last term?
That's right. Essentially what happens is they need to find another tranche of money for it. And so, and inevitably...
So with the new, with the incoming government, then there's an
right.
extension or a reestablishment of these programs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, the first program was the Federal Provincial Partnership.
Federal Provincial Program.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the second one?
Yeah,
second
Federal Provincial Affordable Housing Program.
Right.
And then the other one was the Homelessness Initiative or Homelessness Partnership Initiative.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
And those are both federal provincial programs.
Well, the Homelessness Program is a unilateral federal program. The province is not required to contribute.
Oh, okay. And is the province contributing?
To that one?
Yeah.
No, but they do provide funds in other ways to address the same group of people who are homeless.
Okay.
I mean, they've got through Ministry of Health and CONSAC, they're doing all sorts of support, but there isn't a specific one that might be developing housing that the province has got. The feds do have one.
Okay, so our hope in the short term relies on the extension of these limited but successful existing programs, and our hope in the midterm lies in an increasing availability of land and labor, right?
Yeah.
And our hope in the long term?
More funding. More funding programs. But also, I think...
Sure, the success of these programs making the success of these programs making a case for more.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I also think it's going to rely on creativity and the people who are developing this kind of housing coming up with cost-effective and creative solutions to get the best bang for their buck, because we're going to be looking at a time in the next 5 years where I think every cent is going to be scrutinized pretty carefully.
Yeah. And you say cost-effective and creative solutions, you're thinking of things like, I don't know, I'm just going to throw out some ideas, brownfields, tax repossessions, existing underused city land, existing underused provincial or federal land? Is that what we're kind of thing?
You could say that. I mean, we're already using building on brownfields,
okay,
which, by the way, is usually a really hefty price to clean up, and working on city and federal lands, and provincial lands. That's all happening.
Yeah.
The kind of things which I would be thinking about would be, for instance, there may be ways in which there can be... We've got thousands and hundreds of thousands of units of this type of housing already,
mm-hmm,
and perhaps it's
which type
of the affordable housing,
right,
here in Ontario, and perhaps it's useful. It's about time we thought about looking at the asset base that's there and seeing if there is a way, instead of being entirely dependent on the government, to come up with ways in which we as a social housing sector can use our own resources to lever some of the costs to help keep those costs down, get more housing built for the same amount of government dollars.
When you say look at assets, you mean existing housing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are billions of dollars in assets owned by...
And you're saying that the equity in those assets could be used as a lever.
That's right. Oh, absolutely. And
okay,
that's one of the things right now that there's been reluctance on the government to let that equity be used for new developments, and I think it's time to look at ways in which we can creatively access that equity without putting groups at risk or projects at risk, but in fact enabling that cash to be used to develop housing. In fact, in Britain, a lot of the new housing, affordable rental housing built, uses the equity on the older stock that's been around for 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's actually very common in Britain to develop new affordable rental housing that way.
Okay. All right. So for you, the future looks bright. Can we follow, this sounds like an internal process within the development industry. Can we follow the progress of that initiative to leverage existing stock? I mean, one of the things that came to mind, and it doesn't fit quite the description that you gave, was the mayor's, Mayor Miller's Toronto initiative to make more efficient the existing stock of towers in Toronto, which towers has a greater supply than anyone except New York, apparently.
Well, on the continent, Toronto got more high-rises than any city but New York, and there's only 9 cities in the world with more high-rises than Toronto.
Okay.
So it's quite funny. Yeah, what he's doing is really going to be selling it to private sector. This is private sector stuff. These are buildings built by the private sector in the 60s and 70s, and at a time when there was lots of services in Toronto being rolled out along the major arteries,
mm-hmm,
and now, 30 years later, what we've got are old concrete buildings, really solid buildings, and the analysis shows that if we could come up with cladding to make these buildings more insulated, the cladding itself will pay for itself in a fairly short period of time.
Goodness.
And they're hoping to reduce the carbon footprint by about 5% by just recladding and making these buildings more energy efficient. Yeah, it's a very exciting proposal by the mayor.
Yeah, but apparently endangered, right, in the meantime?
Well, it's endangered, yes, in the sense that there's an economic slowdown, but the key thing here is if it makes sense economically to the building owners to do it, they can make the case that...
Regardless of
the economy, and if oil prices go back from 70 to 120 bucks a barrel, we're going to see everybody jumping back on to do more insulation. And so, in fact, if those prices continue to rise, you may see lots of private owners saying, we're going to have to do this in order to keep this building from breaking the bank. So we may find that the economics will pay for itself of doing this. But it's a very exciting proposal.
So is there any way to follow that except the newspaper?
Oh, yes, there is. There is the firm that developed this. Actually, it's a heritage architectural firm, ERA Architects, here in Toronto.
Yeah.
And they started this tower renewal project by looking at these older 1960s buildings as part of our Toronto heritage,
right. Which,
you know, we're all used to seeing people go back to the Victorians, but here they were looking at what do we do about this. And they're the ones who started the renewal project, and they've got it on their website. It's ERA Architects here in Toronto, and if you Google them, you'd find it. And you could certainly follow what's going to be happening with the renewal project probably there. And I suspect the City of Toronto will also have a web page up.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you think on both these websites there will be information.
I suspect, absolutely, yeah. And I think that once this starts to happen, it's going to be like all sorts of other things. I mean, that the heritage community did, like, doors open that will be other cities will be picking up really quickly. So I think you'll find, if it works in Toronto, it's going to work everywhere else in Canada.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's not as if they didn't have towers in Vancouver, for
that's
sure.
That's right. Well, and even Hamilton's got quite a few.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hadn't noticed that as a function of the housing market in Hamilton, but you're probably right.
Well, you know, when I think about places like, you know, Robinson Street, Herkimer and things like that. I mean, I think about Charlton along there. There's quite a few high rises. Bay Street, you know, they've got quite a bit of high rise there.
I appreciate that. Was there anything that you wanted to say about the future of housing in the downturn and the mechanisms we have in place and are trying to develop to assure more housing for people who are undoubtedly going to end up homeless or very close to homeless in this economy? Anything you wanted to say?
No, actually, I think we've said a lot of it. I think the key is for people who are doing this kind of housing, who are committed to it, to be working with the government and other community organizations to come up with good proposals to develop the kind of housing we need, and creative and cost-effective proposals to make the best uses of our resources.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I really appreciate you coming on the show today, talking to us about this. I mean, it seems pretty simple when you look at it, but there are many different facets of it, and having you lay them out for us and explain the relationship of them, I think it's really important to the listener and certainly been interesting for me.
Okay. Well, you're welcome.
Thanks, John.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to social housing developer John Harstone discuss the present and the future of social housing under declining revenues and falling real estate prices in Ontario. Now, we haven't forgotten your need for something to do when your dinner finishes too soon because your special diet has been reduced. We call it Things to Do When the Special Diet Short Circuits Your Dinner. This week's project, the Peanut Butter Beach. And all you need for this, really, is a couple of those fuzzy toothpicks that come in fancy drinks in hotels. I'm sure your friends can save you some of those. And a jar of peanut butter and a cutting board. Okay, get into the peanut butter with a spoon. Spread it in a crescent shape around the cutting board. This is your beach, and you're going to take a holiday on it. No, don't lie on it. You know, it's sticky. But you can look at it, and you can wish. To complete the beach, all we need are the fuzzy toothpicks. Those are your palm trees. Put the palms in the peanut butter. Now you have palm trees on the beach. Isn't it great? Something to do when your special diet allowance means your dinner falls a little short of the time and the nutrition that you desired. Next week, we'll have companions for your peanut butter beach. And that's all this week for Disrespect. Stay with us on Disrespect. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.